This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
It's not just enough to go green, but how can you bring people along? How can you help the planet regenerate rather than simply maintain sustainability? Sustainability is keeping things as they are. I don't think that's good enough. I think we really have to go to a more regenerative mindset.
What is meant by enlightened self-interest, and how does it inform consumer decisions? Shell Horowitz, a profitability and marketing consultant for green and sustainable businesses, thinks that moving forward, more and more of us will be doing our own legwork when it comes to making well-informed purchasing decisions. Furthermore, he thinks that more socially responsible consumer choices have a hidden bonus, more profit. This week on Sea Change Radio, we speak to Horowitz about the ripple effect of socially responsible business practices into developing nations, talk about the business edge that comes with being a socially responsible company, and break down the role of the general public in all of this. Then we dig into the Sea Change Radio archives and speak with Maya Van Rossum to learn more about her organization, the Delaware River Keepers, and her book, The Green Amendment. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Shell Horowitz. He's a profitability and marketing consultant for green and social change businesses. He's also the author of 10 books. Shell, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thanks so much, Alex. Great to be here.
So we discussed talking about how your basic approach to sustainability can help people work towards solving poverty and hunger. And I wanted to discuss that with you in deeper detail. Why don't you first kind of give us your background and tell us how the work you do can help the most vulnerable ultimately?
Sure. You know, for a long time, we have been attempting to solve things like hunger and poverty and war and catastrophic climate change by using guilt and shame. And the problem with guilt and shame is it doesn't work all that well. So a few years ago, I came up with the idea, and I'm certainly not the first person to think of it, that it might be better to incentivize people to work on these issues through enlightened self-interest rather than guilt and shame. And the tool that I've chosen to work with is the profit motive. If we can show businesses that doing these wonderful things actually brings them more loyal customers, better employees, more motivation in the workplace, better profit margins, lowering expenses, while even creating new markets, what's not to like? So for the last few years, I've been really looking at how to do this and coming up with, I think, some pretty cool ideas about how businesses can really make a difference and a profit. I've been in marketing since I was 15 in 1972, really, but it took a quantum leap in 2000 when I wrapped up a movement that successfully saved a local mountain that a lot of people thought could not be saved. That campaign was 1999 into 2000, and when the dust was settled, I thought, well, gee, that worked so well. Maybe I should be looking more to integrate my activism and my marketing backgrounds. And maybe there are ways that I can make a living helping the world do these things. Just as an example of the sort of thing I'm talking about, because I know this sounds very up in the sky and hard for people to grasp, there are a number of companies out there, including one who's a client of mine, that do solar-powered LED lights. And many of these companies are selling them to replace kerosene. Alex, let me tell you a thing or two about kerosene lamps. First of all, they're flammable, and a lot of people are killed or seriously injured in kerosene fires. Another is that they produce toxic fumes. A third is that they use fossil fuels. And a fourth is that they require paying for kerosene month after month after month. So these companies typically will take a situation where there's a kerosene lamp, replace it with a solar-powered LED that has better light, that has no fumes, that doesn't require fossil fuels, and that actually can be a ladder out of poverty because people can pay for it in, you know, some remote African or Asian village. They can buy it for the same amount of money that they're spending on the kerosene, except that after however many months it takes to pay it off, maybe 10, they can stop paying. And all of a sudden they have considerably more disposable income. If they're, let's say they're making $25 a month and they've been spending $2 a month of kerosene, that's almost a 10% increase in their buying power. Plus the light is better, so that maybe the parents can come home from a day in the fields and start some sort of cottage craft industry. And maybe the kids can get better grades on their homework and therefore do better in school and eventually get better jobs. And you've just built a ladder out of poverty, made the earth better, created a job for the person who is actually selling this system, and on it goes. It's just multiple benefits, and there really isn't a downside. And these are profitable companies doing this.
You talk about giving without shame, giving beyond shame. Why don't you give some examples of how just an ordinary listener can get involved and try to make a difference rather than just throwing their money at a charity?
On the consumer side, we have to remember that we are empowered, that when we band together with others of like mind, we can make a difference. You saw, for example, Nike basically being forced to stop using sweatshops to make its stuff. You've seen the movement for organic, healthy food. These were consumer-driven movements. In fact, I just gave a speech a couple of days ago in which I talked about some of the consumer movements that have led to major changes in my own lifetime. I was born in 1956. The civil rights movement was just really kind of getting going at that time. Then in the 60s, there was the Ban the Bond movement, followed by the Vietnam War movement, followed by that wave of feminism, gay and lesbian liberation, and that kept spiraling out. When I was a child, my family did not eat grapes because there was a boycott on to help the farm workers. Mm-hmm. So through history, there have been movements like this. The power of these movements is such that sometimes it changes governments. You think about South Africa as a classic example, where the divestment movement in the United States plus the citizen movement on the ground in South Africa led to the complete dumping of a very oppressive racist system and the election of Nelson Mandela as the first president of Free South Africa. It's worth mentioning that Mandela, until a couple of years before, had been serving a lifetime sentence in prison. So this is a huge transformation.
And then you talk about businesses being profitable, doing the right thing. Maybe you can give us some examples of companies that you've worked with or read about that don't necessarily have a product that would be geared towards somebody in a developing country. How can they kind of still make a difference?
Think about ice cream. That's something that doesn't travel very well. Mm-hmm. There is a certain ice cream company called Ben & Jerry's. I'm sure you're familiar with them. They've built their whole brand on social and environmental responsibility. They came up out of nowhere. These two guys had no business background and no ice cream background, and they were competing against a very well-funded number one player, Häagen-Dazs, that actually tried to kick them off the supermarket shelves, and they were able to use some guerrilla marketing to turn that around and make Häagen-Dazs look pretty foolish. You know, they're competing against what I call the Exxon of ice cream. And I believe that the only reason that they really got so much prominence, it wasn't that their ice cream was so much better than, like, for example, we have a company called Harold's here in Northampton, Massachusetts. Their ice cream is fantastic. But because Ben & Jerry's has so much of the socially conscious, environmentally conscious market, they were able to become a national brand, whereas Harold's is very much still a local New England brand with, I think they have one store out of the area.
So you really think that social conscious, face-forward brand really kind of set Ben & Jerry's apart from a potential competitor like Harold's?
Yeah, and hundreds of others. I think it did. There are really only two national brands in that space, the super premium ice cream space. And again, these people had no knowledge of what they were doing. They just kind of blundered into a really good product, and they were fun people to build marketing campaigns around. And lo and behold, you know, I used to go to folk festivals and solar fairs, even as far back as the 80s, and you'd see them out there supporting these events and giving out free samples. It was a great strategy. You think about Patagonia, the clothing manufacturer. They are the only company I know that actually put out an ad saying, "Don't buy our stuff." then an ad that said, don't buy this jacket. And basically it was all about reusing and making sure things that you really had a need before you go squandering resources. And it was very effective. And they're, of course, also a national brand. And again, built very much on all the sustainability stuff. But interestingly enough, Alex, a lot of the really huge Fortune 50 companies have begun to figure out that this is where it's at. I went to a conference last year called the Responsible Business Summit, and the speakers were from companies like Coca-Cola and Nestle and Pirelli and Ford. It was really quite exciting to see that this is becoming so mainstream, that all of these companies have their own sustainability departments, that many of them are doing very interesting things involving the bottom of the pyramid customer and how they can be pulled farther along into better personal economies and then become better customers. It's tremendously exciting.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Shell Horowitz. Shell's a profitability and marketing consultant for green and social change businesses. So Shell, I've been to several of those green business conferences, and I can't help but feel at some point that as a consumer, it's very hard to wade through the righteous companies from those who are greenwashing, the ones who are trying to kind of just quickly put the word green or natural on their products and then try to and then see the dollars come in. As somebody who's been in the industry for a long time, maybe you can give consumers a glimpse into how you are able to kind of discern a true green company from a greenwashing organization.
Sure. Well, first of all, Google is your friend in this mission. And a lot can be learned just by that. Like if a company is promoting so-called clean coal or is promoting nuclear power or is promoting earth-damaging agricultural chemicals, you have a pretty good idea that their green story is nothing more than a myth. If they are using a label like all natural, that has no legal meaning. If they're using organic certification, that has a very clear legal meaning. And so far, we've been able to keep that from not including GMOs and some other nasty stuff that some of the companies have tried to get in there. There's now a question about whether if a company is using hydroponic or aquaponic, it should be allowed to have organic certification. I don't know how that one is going to shake out. I personally don't have a big objection to growing plants in water rather than soil, but there is a movement to try to keep those people off the organic label. For paper products, there's something called the Forest Stewardship Council, and they have certifications, and they have different levels of certifications. Some of their certifications really require a big commitment to green, and others are pretty minimal and don't really give the consumer much assurance. So you have to do your research. And fortunately, we live in a society where all of this information is totally public and you can find it in your pocket in about 45 seconds.
Let's say you're the CEO of a small business, 50 to 100 people. You're not even beginning to scratch the surface of a Ben and Jerry's, and your product doesn't necessarily translate into helping the poor in developing nations. What would be some of the ways that you would advise those CEOs to make a difference?
Well, first of all, I'd look at the low-hanging fruit. I read an article a few years ago in which I posited that if you had, let's say, a sports arena, some other kind of building with a high ceiling, that your cost in going to, at that time, LED lamps were like $10 to $20 a piece. They're now about $1 a piece. But the bulbs at that time were still pretty pricey. And I said, you can't just look at the price of the bulb. If you have been changing 50 light bulbs a year and sending somebody out in a cherry picker to change those light bulbs, your cost is not the $10 for the bulb. It is the maybe $50 it's going to cost you to have the person fire up the cherry picker and drive out and go up to the ceiling and take the bulbs down one at a time and replace them. And if the LED lasts you 12 or 15 years and you're changing 50 bulbs a year right now, over the life of that bulb, you could save $4 million. So, you know, every building, every industry, every company is going to be different, but there is going to be low-hanging fruit. It might be as simple as, are your outlets along exterior walls insulated? And if they're not, you're losing a tremendous amount of heat in the wintertime and cooling in the summertime. just easy stuff like that. There's a ton of it that people can do. And then I would say fund the next level of improvements where you have to spend more from the savings you get on these things that cost basically nothing or almost nothing. So, and then start to think about how you can apply that to the social change-y side of it as well, that it's not just enough to go green, but how can you bring people along? How can you help the planet regenerate rather than simply maintain sustainability? Sustainability is keeping things as they are. I don't think that's good enough. I think we really have to go to a more regenerative mindset.
So folks can find you at goingbeyondsustainability.com. Shell Horowitz. Shell, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
A pleasure, Alex. Thanks so much for having me.
How does a one decide that the method he's using, they just won't jive? Truly believe it and try over and over again. Living in hopes that someday he'll be in with the wind of.
Follow the shift to sustainability with Sea Change Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/SeaChangeRadio and on our Facebook page.
I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Maya Van Rossum. She is an environmentalist, an attorney, and an author. Maya, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thanks so much for having me.
You're the Delaware River Keeper. Explain who the Delaware River Keepers are and a little more about the organization that you head.
Sure. So as you said, I am the Delaware River Keeper. I'm the person fortunate enough to be honored to carry that title. And my technical job description as the Delaware River Keeper is to be the voice of the Delaware River. And so to make sure that the needs and the goals and the priorities of the Delaware River are brought into all of those decision-making rooms that would impact the health of the main stem river as well as all of the tributaries that feed it. But of course, protecting a river as large as the Delaware, it's 330 miles long, protecting a river as large as the Delaware or really any natural resource is not the job of one person. It really is the job of a community. And so I have an organization, the Delaware Riverkeeper Network, with 20 staff and 20,000 members. And we work throughout the entire Delaware River watershed, including the four states of New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, and Delaware, and at the national level, to do whatever we have to protect the health of the Delaware River for the benefit of all who depend upon the river.
And your new book is called The Green Amendment, Securing Our Right to a Healthy Environment. Why don't you tell our listeners in a nutshell, if you can, what the Green Amendment is?
My goal with the book, The Green Amendment, is really to help communities recognize that our environmental protection laws, as they're currently written and implemented, are really failing us. That despite all of the legislation and all of the regulations that we have in place, we still have polluted water and polluted air and devastated environments that are devastating people's lives, robbing them of their health and their jobs and healthy economies and good quality of life. And so we need to recognize that something more has to be done to protect our environment. And what I believe that something more is that we need to pass constitutional environmental rights amendments in every state constitution and at the federal level that recognize people's rights to clean water, clean air, and a healthy environment. And doesn't just recognize those rights, but protects those rights the same way we recognize and protect the other fundamental freedoms we hold dear, like, for example, the right to free speech and the right to freedom of religion.
And how much of your work would exist if it weren't for the fracking boom? How much do you end up fighting the oil and gas industry over these shale deposits that seem to be dotting our nation?
So at the Delaware Riverkeeper Network, our work, our organization, well preceded drilling and fracking for gas from shale. And we had plenty of work to do before those industrial operations came to the states of the Delaware River watershed, including Pennsylvania and then threatening New York. So we had a lot to do before drilling and fracking, but we have a lot more to do now that drilling and fracking has come to the region and come to the nation. And so I would say at least half of my time is spent not just battling against drilling and fracking operations, but also battling against all the infrastructure, the pipelines and the compressor stations and the export facilities that are cutting through our environments and cutting through our communities in order to service that devastating industry, which is drilling and fracking for gas.
That's why I asked, is because I assume that since you've been the executive director of Delaware Riverkeeper Network since 1994, I assumed you had been working against polluters and chemical companies, et cetera, who have put the region in environmental jeopardy. I'm wondering how, if those organizations that you used to have to fight against, have they been able to kind of fly under the radar during this fracking boom?
No, we try not to let anybody fly under the radar if they're attacking our environment and attacking our communities. We can't really afford, whether you're talking about fracking or inappropriate development or other industrial operations or polluting dischargers, we can't allow any of them to have a free walk, because all of them are having their impacts on communities and on our environment. And so, unfortunately, with drilling and fracking and pipelines and compressor stations and all of their attacks on our environment, what we really have had to do is ramp up to meet the demand of battling back environmental devastation, rather than just reallocating our attention and our resources to that one industry. We just don't have the luxury of letting any of them fly under the radar. So we really had to rise up to the occasion and just increase our budgets and our actions and our activities and our memberships and all of the work we do on the ground to try to protect our environment and our communities from all of these environmental assaults. And of course, it's just gotten worse since the election of our current president.
Yes, I want to turn to that later, begrudgingly. But in the meantime, why don't we talk about your case that you were one of the original petitioners in, Robinson Township versus Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. Can you lay out the case for us and kind of take us through it, if you will?
Sure. So in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania back in 1971, the state actually passed a Green Amendment, an environmental rights amendment, that recognized and protected the people's right to pure water, clean air, and a healthy environment in the Bill of Rights section of the Constitution. But pretty quickly after that provision was passed, there were some bad court decisions by the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, which really, as the Chief Justice said at the time, disemboweled the provision, really relegated it to just a policy statement and robbed it of the legal force and effect that it should have had. And so for 42 years, the right to a healthy environment, while it was on the books in Pennsylvania's Constitution, it didn't have the force and effect under the law that it should have had and that we needed it to have. And so consequently, industrial operations like drilling and fracking for shale were allowed to run roughshod over Pennsylvania's environment and communities. In 2012, the Pennsylvania legislature passed a piece of legislation called Act 13. It was a piece of legislation that was literally written by the drilling and fracking industry. And it essentially made it even easier for the drillers and the frackers to run roughshod over our environment and over our communities. And it really did a lot of bad things, but I like to just sort of take one example to highlight for people how bad Act 13 was. Act 13 mandated that communities allow drilling and fracking to happen in every part of every community in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania where you had the proper shales, including the communities had to allow drilling and fracking well pads as close as 300 feet from people's homes. So if you can imagine, you know, living your whole life in a beautiful residential community, only to find out one day that you could have a fracking well pad within 300 feet from your home, spewing pollution into the air and noise and literally into the ground, just how devastating that would have been. And so at the Delaware Riverkeeper Network, we have been battling drilling and fracking for many years. And of course, it had entered into the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. Although I will say we did protect the Delaware River watershed from drilling and fracking. We got a moratorium put in place early on that kept it out of our watershed, but it was in our watershed states and putting pressure on the watershed to allow drilling and fracking to happen there. So we realized, you know, once Act 13 was passed that things were going to get even worse, and we had to find a way to challenge it. We did team up with 7 towns and a physician to challenge Act 13, and we each brought our own arguments to the table. At the Delaware Riverkeeper Network, we realized that this may be the moment in time to try to breathe life and strength into that Environmental Rights Amendment. So we actually argued the arguments that the Delaware Riverkeeper Network brought to the table for our team of towns and the physician was that critical provisions of the Environmental Rights Amendment violated the people's rights to pure water, clean air, and a healthy environment in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, and therefore was unconstitutional. And miraculously, wonderfully, the very conservative Supreme Court of the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania largely agreed with us.
Castile.
Chief Justice Castile was also, he was a conservative justice. He was the Chief Justice, and he actually wrote the plurality opinion of the case, and in which the court declared many of the provisions of Act 13 to be unconstitutional because they violated the Environmental Rights Amendment. And so in that moment, not only did we defeat some of the most devastating elements of Act 13, having them declared unconstitutional, but we literally breathed life into the Environmental Rights Amendment of the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. And so in December of 2013, it was almost as if the Environmental Rights Amendment just got passed in December of 2013. And we now had the right to a healthy environment in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. And after all these years of environmental advocacy, I finally got to see the power and importance of constitutional recognition to environmental rights. And that's what sort of led me on the journey to create the Green Amendment movement, or try to create it, and to write the book, The Green Amendment.
Maya Van Rossum, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thanks for having me.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise.
Additional music by Talking Heads and Alan Toussaint.
Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.